Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. Tonight we're up to Book 14, Chapter 1. The Battle of Borodino, with the occupation of Moscow that followed it, and the flight of the French without further conflicts, is one of the most instructive phenomena in history. All historians agree that the external activity of states and nations in their conflicts with one another is expressed in wars, and that as a direct result of greater or less success in war, the political strength of states and nations increases or decreases. Strange as may be the historical account of how some king or emperor, having quarrelled with another, collects an army, fights his enemy's army, gains a victory by killing 3, 5, or 10,000 men, and subjugates a kingdom and an entire nation of several million, all the facts of history, as far as we know it, confirm the truth of the statement that the greater or lesser success of one army against another is the cause, or at least as an essential indication, of an increase or decrease in the strength of the nation. Even though it is unintelligible why the defeat of an army, 1/100th part of a nation, should oblige that whole nation to submit. An army gains a victory, and at once the rights of the conquering nation have increased to the detriment of the defeated. An army has suffered defeat, and at once a people loses its rights in proportion to the severity of the reverse, and if its army suffers a complete defeat, the nation is quite subjugated. So according to history, it has been from the most ancient times, and so it is to our own day. All Napoleon's wars serve to confirm this rule. In proportion to the defeat of the Austrian army, Austria loses its rights and the strength of France increase. The victories of the French at Jena and Auerstadt destroy the independent existence of Prussia. But then in 1812 the French gain a victory near Moscow. Moscow is taken, and after that, with no further battles, it is not Russia that ceases to exist, but the French army of 600,000, and then Napoleonic France itself. To strain the facts to fit the rules of history, to say that the field of battle of Borodino remained in the hands of the Russians, or that after Moscow there were other battles that destroyed Napoleon's army, is impossible. After the French victory at Borodino, there was no great general engagement, nor any that were at all serious, yet the French army ceased to exist. What does this mean? If it were an example taken from the history of China, we might say that it was not an historic phenomenon, which is the historian's usual expedient when anything does not fit their standards. If the matter concerned some brief conflict in which only a small number of troops took part, we might treat it as an exception. But this event occurred before our fathers' eyes, and for them it was a question of the life or death of their fatherland, and it happened in the greatest of all known wars. The period of the campaign of 1812, from the Battle of Borodino to the expulsion of the French, proved that the winning of the battle does not produce a conquest, and is not even an invariable indication of a conquest. It proved that the force which decides the fate of peoples lies not in the conquerors, not even in armies or battles, but in something else. The French historians, describing the condition of the French army before it left Moscow, affirm that all was in order in the Grand Army, except the cavalry, the artillery, and the transport. There was no forage for the horses or the cattle. That was a misfortune no one could remedy, for the peasants of the district burnt their hay rather than let the French have it. The victory gained did not bring the usual results, because the peasants, Karp and Vlas, who after the French had evacuated Moscow drove in their carts to pillage the town, and in general personally failed to manifest any heroic feelings, and the whole innumerable multitude of such peasants did not bring their hay to Moscow for the high price offered them, but burnt it instead. Let us imagine two men who have come out to fight a duel with rapiers according to all the rules of the art of fencing. The fencing has gone on for some time. Suddenly, one of the combatants, feeling himself wounded and understanding that the matter is no joke but concerns his life, throws down his rapier and, seizing the first cudgel that comes to hand, begins to brandish it. Then let us imagine that the combatant who so sensibly employed the best and simplest means to attain his end was at the same time influenced by traditions of chivalry and, desiring to conceal the facts of the case, insisted that he had gained his victory with the rapier according to all the rules of the art. One can imagine the confusion and obscurity would result from such an account of the duel. The fencer who demanded a contest according to the rules of fencing was the French army. His opponent, who threw away the rapier and snatched up the cudgel, was the Russian people. Those who try to explain the matter according to the rules of fencing are the historians who have described the event. After the burning of Smolensk, a war began which did not follow any previous traditions of war. The burning of towns and villages, the retreats after battles, the blow dealt to Borodino and the renewed retreat, the burning of Moscow, the capture of the marauders, the seizure of transports and the guerrilla war were all departures from the rules. Napoleon felt this, and from the time he took up the correct fencing attitude in Moscow, and instead of his opponent's rapier saw a cudgel raised above his head, he did not cease to complain to Kutuzov and to the Emperor Alexander that the war was being carried on contrary to all the rules, as if there were any rules for killing people. In spite of the complaints of the French as to the non-observance of the rules, in spite of the fact that to some highly placed Russians it seemed rather disgraceful to fight with a cudgel, and they wanted to assume a pose en quarte or en tierce, according to all the rules, and to make an adroit thrust en prime, and so on, the cudgel of the people's war was lifted with all its menacing and majestic strength, and without consulting anyone's tastes or rules, and regardless of anything else, it rose and fell with stupid simplicity, but consistently, and belaboured the French till the whole invasion had perished. And it is well for a people who do not, as the French did in 1813, salute according to all the rules of art, and presenting the hilt of their rapier, gracefully and politely hand it to their magnanimous conqueror, but at the same moment of trial, without asking what rules others have adopted in similar cases, simply and easily pick up the first cudgel that comes to hand and strike with it till the feeling of resentment and revenge in their soul yields to a feeling of contempt and compassion. All right, there we go, another chapter down. And we're still away from our characters. Gosh, freaking darn it. What was happening here? That chapter kind of went in one ear and out the other for me. I just finished the chapter and I'm already feeling like I have to run back through it in my mind to remember what I just read. So the French and the Russians playing by different rules of war. The Russians fought dirty, by the looks of it. The French have been doing wars all around the world, and they're very civilized folks, aren't they? They're trying to bring liberty and democracy to the world, and the French way. And, they're following a specific set of rules for war, and then they come to Russia and they find that the Russians aren't doing that. But then again, Tolstoy goes on to say that this is the view of what happened according to historians who were trying to, I suppose, lend more credibility to Napoleon. Chatov Elster said, "We get it, Tolstoy. You don't agree with the historians. Now, give us back our characters." De Fleury said, "I got behind a couple of weeks ago and I caught up, but since then, I'm not sure if I'm ahead or behind. I can't tell one chapter from the next. I feel like I'm in Groundhog Day. Every day I plough ahead and read some more of the same nonsense, and nobody in the story having free will, especially the generals. And oh well, what can you do? It's voting day where I live, and according to Tolstoy, I wasted my time trying to be responsible and research the candidates, since the inevitable winner is going to win no matter how seriously I take the democratic process. Am I making any progress at all? Or am I trapped in an e-reader malfunction loop, reading the same chapter over and over again? Perhaps this is why no one ever finishes the book. There is no end. It's bigger on the inside, and you just keep reading this section until you die. Wow, De Fleury, that was beautiful. Beautiful and worrying. I really like that comment. That's a pretty grim take on what's going on, but I can relate. If I didn't have a paperback version of the book, I might be worried the same thing. But yeah, these last, I'm going to say, 20 or so chapters have mostly just been the same stuff over and over. Jen Whatup said, I'm definitely missing the peace chapters. But Too Clever by 87/15 had a different take. They said, I can't be the only person who actually likes these chapters. Tolstoy's philosophical and historical musings are just as important to the story as the characters, and if you can't see that, I question how you've gotten this far into the book. Yeah, well, that's fair enough to question such a thing, because there has been chapters in this book where my interest in reading on has dipped, like, critically low. And I reckon it's pretty fair to say that if I wasn't doing this as a one-year challenge, I would have done one of two things. I would have either skim read ahead, like kept reading, but just skim. Or I would have just probably put the book down and lost interest. That's being completely honest. I mean, I like these chapters too. And I do think they're important. I just think they're drawn out to a length that, yeah, it becomes boring. There's no other way to put it, really. For me, at least. I think, yeah, I don't know, maybe I'm just simple-minded, but characters fascinate me, I suppose. I'm reminded of this comment I once heard. It was like, dumb people talk about other people. Smart people talk about... Smart people talk about, like, things or something like that. And really smart people talk about ideas. It was something like that. But it was, I think, at the top tier of smartness, it was people with, like, ideas and philosophy and that kind of thing. And at the bottom tier, it was people like... The dumb people just like to gossip about other people. So maybe I'm down in that bottom tier where characters is what grabs my attention, you know? What Napoleon did, how he was defeated, whether he was a great man or not, is a fascinating question to me, no doubt, and I love exploring it. But I also cannot look away from a love triangle. I just can't do it. You throw a love triangle in there, and I'm going to be more interested in that than learning about Tolstoy. Huh. What does that say about me? I suppose I'm just kind of dumb. But hey, Tolstoy knew that as well, because he put that love icosahedron in the story earlier with about 20 different sides to it. So he knew what he was doing. All right, that's going to do us for today's chapter. Thanks very much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.